Welcome to MSU Today on 870 AM WKAR. I'm Russ White. At 6 past the hour following the latest news, it's a Greening of the Great Lakes Sustainability Roundtable conversation. Kirk Heinze talks environment-related matters with Mark Shupan, Doug Bueller, and Diane Byram.
The economics are changing such that, and the advancements in technology and R&D, that I believe private sector is going to continue to seek more renewable energy regardless of what's going on at the EPA. And once battery technology is fully operational and we make that breakthrough so we can store renewable energy, that's a game changer.
This is MSU Today on 870 AM WKAR, and we get started at 4:06. You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's that time of the year when we reflect on a variety of sustainability-related topics with our Sustainability Roundtable. This is our fourth year now, and the first time we'll be looking at a new administration in Washington. Our distinguished panel has once again agreed to share their expertise and insights on some of the key economic, environmental, and social issues facing the U.S., Michigan, and the Great Lakes region. Our panelists are Diane Byram, partner and co-founder of Byram and Fisk Advocacy Communications. She's also a recently re-elected member of the MSU Board of Trustees. Byram and Fisk also serves as the communication arm of the Agriculture Leaders of Michigan, ALM. We also have back Mark Shupan, Chief Executive Officer of Shupan & Sons, headquartered in Kalamazoo. Shupan & Sons has grown into a national and international business with three major divisions: metal, plastic recycling, processing, and sales. And good friend Doug Bueller, Assistant Vice President of Research and Graduate Studies at Michigan State University, also Director of MSU Ag Bio Research, which supports the work of more than 300 scientists in seven colleges at Michigan State University. It's a pleasure to welcome each of you back to Greening of the Great Lakes.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Let's take a moment. We're going to do some speculation, some looking back, some looking forward. I mentioned in the open that we'll have a new administration in Washington for the first time since we started this panel. Let's take a look back briefly at the Obama administration, the last 8 years. On the sustainability environmental front, what are some things that happened that you think went well, and what were some things that perhaps did not get done? Diane?
Do you want me to take the first crack at that? Well, I think in terms of technology and renewable energy, there was quite a bit of activity. There were tax credits and incentives to be able to build out renewable energy. And we saw the prices of renewable energy drop substantially. So they're much more competitive with conventional coal-fired power plants or something like that. So I think that's something that went really well. I do think that there were some struggles in terms of trying to move beyond a carbon economy. So we had the carbon cap. That legislation didn't go anyplace early in his career. And then I think there was a lot of misfires on things like WOTUS and Clean Power Plan is going to get tied up into the courts. So those things won't be completed under the Obama presidency.
Yeah, we'll come back to the Environmental Protection Agency a little bit later. But, Mark, your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are always a little different. But on the positive, I always want to start on the positive. The positive, I think, some of the incentives to do things, for example, the natural gas opportunities there, and we took advantage of them, which was good for us and good for the. We always talk about the 16 semis we run for our beverage container pickup. Each one of them's like taking 300 cars a day off the road from a carbon standpoint. It's a different world right now with where prices are, and once those incentives are gone, it's going to be a little more challenging for sure. On a very macro basis, you know, being in business, the 8 years there are a fair amount of challenges to if you owned a business, the additional costs and things that are involved. And the other thing, too, is I really believe we need to be self-sustaining as a country. for our energy needs. And again, not not in a polluting way, but I think there's probably some things that we'll find that make a lot more sense, that where the downstream effect for people in their lives and costs, I think, are going to improve.
Doug?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I think has certainly been gratifying thinking about trying to continue research progress on some of these things is that even though with the drop in oil prices and so on, a lot of the support for some of the longer-term alternatives, biofuels, has continued, and we certainly hope that that's going to continue because MSU has been one of the major players in that with the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center that we are co-leaders with University of Wisconsin. And so that has continued to move on because this is not something that's going to be able to be solved in terms of how oil prices swing one way or another. And we know sooner or later we're going to have alternatives and new ways to do things. And how do we fit these things into the agricultural landscape? How do we balance the needs for energy? We haven't talked about it so much lately because grain supplies are high, but it wasn't that many years ago that we were worried about the whole food versus fuel debate. Those things are going to come back again. And so for us, who are charged with trying to figure out some really different solutions, we've got to stay diligent on these things when they're not front and center every day, because these things will come back, and they're going to be just as complicated then as they are now. And so that part, I think, we feel good about. Where it's going to go from here, who knows? But, we feel we have very good, strong scientists that will be able to respond to the opportunities and continue to move the science forward in this area.
We're talking sustainability with our Sustainability Roundtable. We do this every year about this time. We have Diane Byram, who is a partner in Byram and Fisk Advocacy Communication, Mark Shupan, Chief Executive Officer of Shupan and Sons, and Doug Bueller, Assistant Vice President of Research and Graduate Studies at Michigan State. We just talked a little bit about the Obama administration looking back. A lot of folks are wondering what's going to happen under the new regime. And Diane, you mentioned in the opening segment the Environmental Protection Agency and the waters of the United States. On the same day that President-elect Trump tapped Scott Pruitt to head the EPA, Google announced that they were committed to 100% renewable energy. Pruitt is a strong advocate of the coal and gas industry. Where do you think the EPA might be headed under a Trump administration?
Well, I think there's going to be a lot of speculation, and that's exactly what it is. It would be speculation. And the answer is I don't think we know yet. We know who his recommendation is for the director of the EPA, and we know that person's history. But a lot of what's going to be going on in terms of renewable energy is going to be done through the private sector. You mentioned Google's announcement. GM made a similar announcement earlier this year that they want to be 100% renewable energy globally. I believe it was 2050, and they're well on their way on their global footprint. We have
Ford's done the same thing.
Right. We have Switch in Grand Rapids that is coming in. They're a data center. They want to be 100% renewable energy, and Consumers Energy, their energy provider, is trying to figure out with them how that's going to occur. The economics are changing such that, and the advancements in technology and R&D, that I believe private sector is going to continue to seek more renewable energy regardless of what's going on at the EPA. And it really calls for a lot in research and development, those new technologies. Natural gas is dominating over coal because of price. And in Michigan, that's going to continue to happen. We're going to continue to retire very old coal-fired power plants, and the switch will be to natural gas for baseload, and then you can integrate renewables very easily there for the least cost kilowatt of electricity. At Michigan State University, we're putting a solar array up that'll be fully operational here in the next year. We made that decision because of cost. That was an economic-driven decision. Yes, it fit into our goals to have more renewable energy on campus, but it, at the end of the day, it was an economic decision for the university. So I think you're still going to see progress. And once battery technology is fully operational and we make that breakthrough so we can store renewable energy, that's a game changer. And that will have the effect of what we have seen in the telecommunications industry. It's an absolute game changer for everyone. And that's with probably within the next 5 years. Michigan State has a piece of that, too. So I hope Doug Buehler will talk a little bit about our battery technology research.
Well, yeah, I don't. Yeah, at this point, I mean, it's moving along, and I think at this point I would agree with what Diane has said, because I think once those things occur, it's going to change the whole solar business. It's going to change electric cars. It's going to change the things that people can do on the roofs of their houses. The the glass panels, for example, mm-hmm. are something that are very exciting from all sorts of angles. We even talk about. You know, we're looking to hopefully build some new greenhouses on campus for our research, which is a very expensive endeavor. Well, if we could use that type of technology for greenhouses, what an impact that would have on our greenhouse industries and things like that and those ability. And I think you said something that's really important and that we look at, you know, as we sort of anticipate and try to reposition ourselves research-wise to keep things going. The things that are eventually going to go are those that are both economically make economic sense and make environmental sense. And with two of those link, then there's going to be, it doesn't matter really how you view the world, what your view of the world is, it makes sense to everybody. And that's the kind of thing, I think we have to get away from this, whether it's an economic issue or it's an environmental issue. We have to do the right things that do mm-hmm. both. And some of these new technologies that bring the cost down and allow us to meet these goals are really what's going to, I think, make it go. And then are going to create very good opportunities for the private sector to get involved and to make these things go, because you're absolutely right. Ultimately, it's the private sector that's going to have to make this all go.
Well, Mark, you're the private sector here. You're the representative of the private sector. Well, you're talking economic and environmental sustainability working hand in hand. That's certainly right in your wheelhouse in the recycling industry.
There's no doubt about that. Those are those are great comments that you both had, though. It was interesting listening. Mark Twain once said, you can never go wrong doing the right thing. And I also think sometimes no good deed goes unpunished, so they sort of they're sort of at different ends. But I think the idea, I think, more in the future, now, because you don't know with Donald Trump yet how much influence will be by the people they bring in. But I think we're going to do more things that make common sense from an economic standpoint. I joke about it. I write a letter, and my last thing was basically talking was that Donald probably won't nuke the whales. He probably won't, but I know there's so much fear of what could happen. But I think, as you're saying, if it makes good economic sense and environmentally is strong, I don't think anybody's gonna have a challenge. What we're gonna get away from, I think, is doing some things that do not make economic sense. And eventually, there's a downstream cost to the public. And what we want to do is make sure that whatever we're doing is fair to the public, too, because somebody's going to have to pay for it. So that's where I am right now. And as far as the recycling, you know, obviously, a lot's going to depend on our relationship with China, because they are the very important in what the commodity prices are, basically, because of what they produce now. And so can be very, very interesting. Right now, talking about recycling and the economy, there are winners and there's losers in our economy right today. And we'll talk, I don't know if you're going to talk about unemployment a little bit or anything like that, but even though we show the lowest unemployment we've ever had, we also have the lowest number of people in the workforce that we've had in four decades. And my idea, if you're not looking for work, you're no longer unemployed, is not a good way to measure. So there's a lot of things that are going to happen, and I know we are looking for people, have a real challenge today, because there is a shortage of skilled workers, but not a shortage of people that need training. So we'll see what happens and mm-hmm. how that will fit.
Well, Mark, you opened up a couple of topics that I have on my list, a couple that Diane has sent us ahead of time. You mentioned the importance of trade and the relationship with China and the recycling industry. We do have some international trade policies in place, NAFTA being one of those. Mm-hmm. We have one on the table that's being discussed, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Where might we be headed with international trade? And, Diane, I'll turn to you on this one first, too. From an agricultural perspective, international trade is pretty important.
It's critical for agriculture, and it is the backbone of Michigan agriculture, and they must have trade in order to be able to survive into cash flow. And, yes, China is a very big trading partner. NAFTA's extremely important, too. So NAFTA may get massaged a little bit. I don't believe NAFTA's going away. TPP is probably not even on life support at this point. Serious issues there. We do have to figure out, though, trading relationships, not only for agriculture, but it really underpins the entire U.S. economy. And so it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, but trade is very important for everyone.
We have our annual Sustainability Roundtable with Mark Schupan, Chief Executive Officer of Schupan & Sons, Doug Bueller, Assistant Vice President of Research and Graduate Studies at MSU, and Diane Byram, who's a partner in Byram and Fisk Advocacy Communications. Diane just made some comments about the importance of trade, not only for the agricultural sector, but in general, international trade. Mark, where are you on the international trade front?
Well, obviously, it's huge. I am concerned. I believe in free trade, but I also believe in fair trade, and we have had some challenges there. The world is it's the world, one world for all of us, and the more we do as far as trading, the better our political relationships become. I'm a little concerned. We're probably going to raise our interest rates this month, which what that will do is it'll drive the dollar up again, and the stronger the dollar is, the harder it is for exports for us. But we're the best game in town as far as our economy, if you look around the world. And so a lot of funds tend to want to flow here to make things. And then the other thing is just, there's only 8% manufacturing in the United States, and at one time was a 30%. It's not coming back to that tech. There's so much technology, and there's certain jobs that will never come back. On the other hand, we have to make things in the United States. And so I think we're going to start making a few more things. I really do here.
And your point about fair trade, free trade, that's been resonating with us for a long time in the United States. I mean, yeah, let's open up trade, but let's make sure that we're playing on a level playing field. Doug?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this kind of, it gets a little bit on the edge of the things that I do every day, but just a couple things that come to mind, I think, where sort of the research enterprise and what MSU does can play in here. We haven't talked much about, and I don't think we'll have time to get to it today, but the role of, you know, the issues around genetic modification and where that plays into trade. And one of the things that we're involved with internationally is helping other countries with biosafety and understanding these regulations. And so if there's things we can do to help change some of those things, that will also help open up markets. And another place where we're making some new investments is in processing, which, you know, will help keep things, in some ways, keep things in our state, but also hopefully that we can develop new and high-end products that will be very attractive. I was just last night with some folks talking about how much the Koreans love Michigan cherries, for example. How can we continue to develop some of those markets, improve how we process things, and those kind of things. So I think there is, you know, certainly a role for science and certainly for education in all of this, and how all these things fit together, I think, are going to be certainly a challenge for all of us.
Another issue, Mark, you alluded to it earlier, Diane as well, is a workforce and the need for folks in agriculture, in other sectors, and a lot of folks are not being in the pool any longer looking for jobs. Immigration reform, I mean, if sustainability and immigration go hand in hand, it's an economic issue, it's certainly a sociocultural issue, one might even argue in many ways an environmental issue as well. We've had several administrations promise immigration reform over the past several decades, but it hasn't happened. Is it going to happen?
I'm hopeful that it will happen, because I think it's getting more and more critical to the economy. There was just an article in MLive here in the last week or so where the agricultural community is trying to reach out and get driver's licenses reinstated for immigrants. So they can't get a driver's license, therefore they're either driving illegally or they're not driving, and it's an important issue for agriculture. Farm Bureau has a whole subgroup or a task force working on immigration because it's so important across the ag commodities, but particularly in dairy and when the livestock industry generally. So I think we're going to have to deal with immigration.
I was just on a panel a couple of days ago for MI Business, and they had, I don't know, about 10 or 12 of us, all primarily manufacturers, but everyone, the same thing was, you know, how do we keep people, how do we find people? Certainly the new generation is a little different in their aspect of work and how important culture is. And I don't know if this, but as far as, we're a nation of immigrants, and we should have be open to the point where there are opportunities, and I don't think we want to spend tremendous times educating people over here and then sending them away when we really have a need for them. So I'm hoping we'll do better in that venue, but we'll see.
Yeah, I would just add, this is something that I think that we've been looking at differently here at MSU as well, particularly as it relates to our interactions with community colleges to do more training. One of the nice things about the state of Michigan is that traditionally the agricultural programs have been very concentrated at MSU, but that isn't always the best thing, because some of the things I think that are needed right now, particularly getting people ready to work on high-end with computer technology and things, that's really not something that we do. But what we are doing is reaching out and developing a number of new relationships with community colleges, helping them prepare these people for the workforce where they're right there in the community, they can learn these things and they can go to work. And that links into a lot of different things we're doing here, from processing to high-end pest management and a lot of these things. And so I think we're all trying to respond and address these things from different angles, because it's not a simple problem.
Yeah, I'm real excited with the relationships with community colleges, the partnerships the College of Ag has. There's some 8 of them and growing, and it allows a student to stay locally, and they get a community college degree, they get a certificate from Michigan State University, and then given a grade point of 3.0 or higher, they get a seat in the College of Ag straight in. And so they don't have to stop at an associate's degree. If they want to get a bachelor's or a master's or a PhD, it's wide open to whatever their dreams are.
Yeah, and we just did an interview on a new drone technology program up in mm-hmm. Northwest Michigan, which is obviously looking at some of the latest in technology and applying it to spatial research and mm-hmm. agriculture. And the kids are fired up about drones. I mean, perfect example.
Well, the technology just to run a tractor.
Yeah,
I mean, a sprayer. You pull up with a lat top if you're going to do service on farm equipment today. It's not a lot of wrenches necessarily.
Yeah, and just to follow up, the program with the drones up in the Northwest has been something that's been a little bit different, because this is one of the first meaningful integrated interactions that we've had with a community college at one of our research centers. So they're doing that work in collaboration with our folks at the Northwest Heart Station. The Traverse City area, and mm-hmm. so that's very exciting. And we're looking at some other opportunities where the community colleges can use our research centers, research and extension centers, to get those kids out, whether it's into a vineyard or whatever, to get that training. And so I think there's a lot of opportunities and some good things going on in that area.
Yeah, it's extremely exciting, because not only are you training a workforce, but it's also rural development. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to have economic spinoff with these partnerships. So I'm very excited about it.
Well, as long as we're talking about community colleges in Northwest Michigan, let's talk a little bit more about Michigan and the Great Lakes region. Let's talk water here for a moment. The importance of water, the interface of water and energy and environment and food and all of those sorts of things. How important is the ongoing restoration of the Great Lakes Initiative, Mark?
Well, considering we are in Flint right now every day, and we've been there from 2 weeks after their crisis, I think we've gone through 6 million containers that we've recycled up there for PET. We see it every day how important it is. And the one thing about Michigan is why we are so attractive is we do have water. Do we want to protect it? Absolutely. And I don't think there's anybody that does not want to protect the water. And as long as we do it in ways that have some common sense, I'm 100% there. So,
yeah, and you mentioned a lot of folks got involved in Flint early on, but Shupan was one of the first companies to be engaged up there. I mean, that was a wonderful initiative. Michigan State was involved heavily and has been and continues to be. But a tragedy with a lot of opportunities maybe coming out of the other end.
Well, we certainly hope so. And unfortunately, I'm afraid that situation may be a canary in a coal mine, and we're looking all across the country of, you know, what challenges there may be. And again, hopefully, certainly, we can begin to correct some things before they become a problem.
So. Yeah, it's all about infrastructure and the amount of investment that it's going to take to update that infrastructure that's been in place for over 100 years in some cases.
Mark just alluded to the importance of water and the example in Flint, but water is huge. Michigan State's making a major push this year within the context of water. Where are we going with water research?
Well, I mean, water research at MSU has been a big deal for us for a long time, but some of these things are, you know, we need to be retooling a little bit, because I think, you know, some of the comments earlier about, you know, how do we really balance using that resource in a productive way but still protecting it, which is certainly a big deal. The issues around invasive species, some of the issues in terms of transportation, all of these things linked together. I know, how far can we go with irrigation? You know, that's something that is certainly important to us in terms of how do we manage water and withdrawals, things like that. But on the other hand, some of the, I think, newer products and opportunities that we have, and specialty crops, are often crops that are irrigated. And so I think we've got to balance all of those things out. But we're going to continue to focus there. I think the strength of our water research was recognized last fall when one of our own, Joan Rose, got the Stockholm Water Prize, which is the water prize in the entire world.
So it's the Nobel Prize of water.
Yes, and we're looking at some new ways, actually doing some things a little bit differently in terms of how we're organizing our water research, trying to get a little bit more interaction amongst engineers, biologists, hydrologists, people like that, because we know the important things are very complicated, and we need minds with different perspectives to come in and view these, everything from the economics all the way down to the hydrology and everything in between.
Yeah, I would agree. Water is a very important issue, and it's one that's going to be around for a long, long time. And you're looking at, the private sector is looking at, how can we conserve water? How can we reduce the amount of water that we're using in our manufacturing processes, whether that is manufacturing a can of soda or whether it's taking a crop to market? So that's going to continue, and along with the quality of water. We've got a phosphorus problem in the western basin of Lake Erie, and a lot of that is soluble phosphorus, which needs a ton of research to understand exactly what is going on and how we might look at tools. We need new tools in the toolbox to be able to address soluble phosphorus. That's research.
Yes.
And so I'm hoping that we kind of turn a focus towards the soluble phosphorus. We know all about particulate. That isn't going to get it cleaned up for us.
Yeah. Well, you make a good point. We don't have time to go into it here, but sometimes it's not safe to assume that we think we know some things, because that whole soluble phosphorus thing is against all of the things that a lot of us were taught
right.
in Soil Science 101. So it's a new game. It's
absolutely
a game changer in the whole thing.
Well, I miss Soil Science 101, but
just so that's, you know, two of us.
But just to give you an idea, you know, how this affects manufacturing or whatever, we just put in a system in our Wixom plant to handle out-of-date soft drink and beer, where to be able to make sure that water is or their product is disposed of in an environmentally positive way. And it was a pretty substantial investment, but we know it's again the right thing to do for the future.
Mm-hmm. So, we talked to a Ford executive recently, and they're committed to cradle to cradle with their water. But what they found over the last 10 years of water management, and how much money they've saved in the process.
Right.
In addition, back to your points about economically sustainable and environmentally sustainable at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Something happened here recently in Michigan, some new legislation on brownfield redevelopments. Mm-hmm. Dan Gilbert, an MSU alum, was instrumental in helping get that legislation passed. For the most part, it's been very favorably received. We certainly have enough brownfields to redevelop in the state of Michigan.
Yeah, that's an understatement. Every little town has a brownfield.
I want to throw something else in. We didn't discuss it, but 3 years ago we bought an electronics recycling company, very small, and is now much larger, and we're looking at investments there. But I think you're going to find more and more that there's going to be legislation in every state of how they dispose of their electronics recycling. And it's an interesting field. It's growing, and takes a lot of capital, but I think has a great future. And I think for our company, in 3 years, it's going to be a major part of what we do.
And back to what you said earlier, that probably the success of electronics recycling probably has a lot to do with relationships with some foreign countries like China.
Well, somewhat China, but also when you look at where the refineries for the gold thing are in Japan, not China. Mm-hmm. China was always known, but you could send something over, they would take things apart. And the other thing is, what you call an R2 rating of how things are done environmentally all the way down the chain, so that you're not shipping things somewhere else in the world that can cause them problems too. So there's a lot of things going on right now. We just had four Japanese manufacturers, but anyway, they're ones involved very heavily in the government of how they make decisions on whether or not they'll even do business with people if they don't have that R2 rating, because they're interested in their environment for sure.
Well, we have a couple of minutes left here, but this is an opportunity that I always like to give our panelists to say some things about maybe things they're going to be looking at in particular as we project ahead to 2017 across the broad sustainability front. And we'll start with you, Doug.
Well, thanks, I guess. I think the thing that I would say, this is obviously a very interesting time to be alive. And I think, I think there's been some messages sent by our country, and I think we need to look at that seriously and respond to that. In terms of kind of, looking at how do we position our research, what we really try to do when we hire people is we try to hire people that have very strong skills in their fundamental discipline. And as a public research institution, it's our job to respond to the challenges and the needs of the society. And so if some of those things change, we need to be looking at how do we reposition ourselves. How can people, that, for example, someone who's a world-class plant geneticist, apply those skills in something different? And so I think that's what we're going to have to look. We'll continue to look. And certainly, we're always interested in what the president and what the Congress is looking at in terms of what science policy is, but we also need to recognize that we've had very good support from the state of Michigan in recent years, and we hope that that's going to continue, and that's been a very important part of what we do, too. So it's going to be interesting, but there's going to be good challenges, and then hopefully we'll be ready to step up.
Mark?
Well, I have a quote I like, another quote that I really like. God never gives you more than you can handle, but I wish you didn't trust me so much. That was Mother Teresa. And that's, I'm sure all of you feel that some days. But my it's going to be very interesting when they talk about these tax reductions and this and that and whatever. And the question is there's one thing having a reduction. The other thing is how are you going to use that? Now, if you have incentives to say, okay, we're going to give money for training, for more hiring people, for doing things, not just, reducing things, I think some things like that are going to happen. It's never as bad as you think it's going to be, never as good. I'm excited. We have more employees than we've ever had, that's for sure. We're well over 500 now. We have an acquisition that will be announced. Unfortunately, it's not in Michigan, coming up in the next probably 30 to 45 days. So we're positive, and I think you have to just, again, things are changing so fast that you got to be like the old Gretzky. You don't go where the puck is; you go where it's going to be, and you have to be nimble. And we're going to try to do that so that we're sustainable for the future. Recycling's not going away for sure, and the question is what areas can you grow in and have value to your customers and to your communities? And we're certainly going to try to use that as our direction.
And we'll get the final word from Diane Byron.
Well, thank you. I'm going to echo what both of my colleagues have said. This is clearly very interesting times, and the speed of change is very fast. And I'm positive and upbeat about the future. I think there's going to be lots of opportunity. It is going to be different. The speed of change is going to be both interesting and exciting. And from my perspective, when I take a look at the agricultural sector, it's still going to be all about transportation, energy, water, and how do you continue to produce a high-quality product, food, with less and less resources. And so that's exciting.
Well, lots. I like the optimistic notes that you all sounded at the end of this. So next year, a year from now, we might have some extremely interesting things to talk about, just like we did this year and just like we have had for the past 4 years. I want to thank Diane Byram, co-founder and partner of Byram and Fisk, Mark Shupan, Chief Executive Officer of Shupan and Sons, and Dr. Doug Buehler, Assistant Vice President of Research and Graduate Studies at Michigan State University. Always appreciate your time and your expertise this time of the year. Number four is in the can, and we'll look forward to doing this again next year.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. Looking forward to it.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with a sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes segment inside MSU Today here on AM 870 WKAR. To read Kirk's blog and hear more Greening of the Great Lakes content, visit mlive.com/environment. I'm Russ White for MSU Today. Establishing more endowed chair professorships is a key goal of MSU's Empower Extraordinary campaign, says MSU Provost June Pierce Hewitt, and the endowments are a key piece in attracting the best faculty talent to MSU.
Well, if you look across our endowed chairs and professors, they really represent some of the finest scholars, researchers, artists, not just in the country, but really internationally. And we have recruited them to MSU for their intellectual leadership. The endowment piece of this becomes very, very important for these individuals. It isn't, certainly it's the title, it's the recognition, and that's well-deserved. It's as if one is the first chair in the orchestra or the first string on the team. But the endowment that comes with it, the unrestricted funds to pursue work, becomes very, very important for people who are very good and very innovative. All of these people, I believe probably all without exception, certainly have their work funded externally by foundations and national organizations and governments, but government agencies, but people who are very, very capable and who are truly leaders often are out ahead of those funding agents. They have the big idea. They have the hunch long before the funding agent issues a request for a proposal. And so making sure that those individuals have those resources at hand to begin to work on the next big idea becomes very, very important.
I'm Deborah Verholden, and I am one of the C.S. Mott Endowed Professors of Public Health in the new Public Health Division in the College of Human Medicine located in Flint.
An endowed position is what enticed Dr. Verholden back to her hometown.
So being a C.S. Mott Endowed Professor, which kind of makes me laugh every time I say it, it sounds very important. But what it is the C.S. Mott Foundation, who is very invested in Flint, literally located a block from our building, got together with the community, MSU, and they did a comprehensive needs assessment, really looking at what are some of the greatest challenges that Flint faces and how could a university foundation community partnership come together to address some of those challenges. So the endowment is important because it is the investment from the Mott Foundation to secure the positions to actually bring public health researchers and public health faculty here front line to help to deal with some of these challenges. So the endowment is the investment of the C.S. Mott Foundation and the future of public health in Flint.
Microbiologist Victor Derrida returned to his roots at MSU from the University of Michigan to assume an endowed position and chair a department. He says the private funding from donors...
It's absolutely essential. And not because of me, you know, I mean, but because I'm going to put away the Rudolph Hugh Endowed Chair side for now and adopt the Department of Microbiology and Molecular Genetics chair. Okay, so I'm competing for people all the time. I sort of think of myself as the general manager of a baseball team. All right, if we want to build strength, we can do it two ways. We can grow it in our farm system. We have some great, outstanding assistant professors here that we want to make sure that they stay happy. Or we can go out and find it in the free agent market. And the only way to get the free agents onto the campus is to have endowed professorships. That is talk about anteing up. What are we anteing up to get somebody who's already established somewhere else They've got what they want somewhere else, but an endowed chair can really make them pay attention. So if we're going to build strength, we have to do it by going into the free agent market and keeping the people that we have happy as well, the young people. So, by the way, once the people that we start out in our farm system start doing well, they start to look like people that can be poached by other places, so we have to have something in place for them. The endowed chairs are essential for that. They are absolutely essential for that. When people get into my position, eventually, you know, it's nice to have, you know, in your signature line to have that you're an endowed chair. This or that's kind of cool. We're building a team here, and building the team requires that we grow the farm system and that we hire free agents. And the way that we get free agents is with endowed professorships, not because Michigan State's not a great place, but because they're very happy where they're at. So what is it going to take to get them to move? An endowed chair is at least will start the engine. Doesn't mean it's going to happen, but there's no way I could seriously go after somebody or would who's already established somewhere else without going after them with an endowment.
They can go any place, often places where the winters aren't quite so harsh and the laboratories might be a little newer. And where there may be a few more fine restaurants within driving distance. And so one of the ways in which one recruits in that environment is to be able to offer an endowed chair professorship. Unfortunately, we have very few of those. We're celebrating those that we do have, and it truly is a celebration because we've done very well during this campaign. But we began this effort with the fewest number of endowed chairs or professorships in the Big Ten. Again, that makes it very difficult when one of our sister schools, a very, very good school, each of us want the same individual, and one of us can offer the status of a chair, the recognition of a chair, the funding of a chair, and the other cannot. And it's very difficult in that environment to go head-to-head with these good places. And so this is the advantage that makes all the difference, and there is something quite amazing about how one attracts talent, because one good person attracts another good person who attracts another good person. People very much want to work in the kind of environment where they have the kind of stimulation that comes from being surrounded by the best.
Al and Nancy Gambrell established an endowed chair professorship, and Al said at the recent investiture ceremony honoring faculty who recently received their positions that donors have varied reasons for creating this legacy.
For Nancy and me, it was all about helping our students to have the opportunity to learn from and to be inspired by our faculty, the best of the best. And that's exactly what happened to me about 40-some years ago. I was in a class with Dr. Larry Foster, who some of you might know, and he did a lecture on organizational behavior, and he really knocked it out of the park in my mind, and it made me, or led me, to be inspired to choose my career in human resources. And 40 years later, I would say that I'm still inspired by that, and so Nancy and I, when we found our way to Empower Extraordinary, we wanted to make sure that we were doing something that would allow for every student here to be inspired by great professors.
Having an endowment sends a clear signal to the researcher and to the professor that there's an investment, there's an at-stakeness. If you want to know where people's values are, you look to see where they spend their resources. So when people endow positions the way the Mott Foundation endowed these positions at Michigan State, it's a clear indication that this matters. And who doesn't want to be someplace where you know that you matter, where the work that you do is a key part of the value system of the institution? So the endowment does make a big difference. It's a signal both to the community that there's a real investment, but it's also a signal to the faculty member that we are here and we are investing in you.
Provost Hewitt says establishing endowed chair professorships will continue to be a focus of the Empower Extraordinary campaign.
We've emphasized throughout this campaign several priorities, but we probably haven't talked about anything more than chairs and professorships, because this is the quality of the institution. This is the ultimate investment. This is the way in which we assure that quality continues in this place. I've said to more than one donor, if you care deeply about making sure that an area of study is attended to by the very best and always attended to, no matter how funds flow, come and go, no matter how funding agencies shift in their priorities. If this is a priority in your life, if this is something you're willing to invest in beyond today, beyond to tomorrow, then investing in a endowed chair professorship is really probably the ultimate place to invest. It's a way to carry not just the area of work, but in many cases, it honors their family. That's for whom the chair is named. We have others that are named in honor of a professor or a mentor that really helped shape their lives. It becomes a very, very high priority. We care a great deal about scholarships and fellowships for our students. That's an outstanding investment as well. But chairs and professorships really change the quality of the institution.
The endowment also creates a sustainability for positions. I mean, mostly we're a soft money world. You know, when you're a researcher, you're paid primarily from grants, which are soft money. And the tides, you know, change and turn, and you know people go into funding troughs. But with the endowment, there is some sustainability and a basic infrastructure of support that does allow the faculty to have a certain sense of security and stability in their research programs, which does create opportunities to attract the nation's best and brightest students, postdocs, fellows, and recruit other faculty. So even within our division, we are actively in the search process for an additional 4 faculty to join us within the next year.
What really happens at universities, and what has to happen, is we discover new things in nature. And the research is slow, it's expensive, and it's the predicate for all of the discoveries that are going to be beneficial to people. But the basic science that gets done at universities like Michigan State is so important. And I think we sometimes mislead the public by suggesting that, oh, we made this interesting finding, and that's going to lead to this new drug or this new antibiotic. It may, but the important thing is that we made the finding. And this basic science that drives this findings is really, really important. And it's expensive, as I said, and it's always a challenge to say, here's the line between this finding and this cure. But we know the finding is important, and we're doing this investigation because we want to uncover how nature works. We know over the eons that we've been doing this that once we uncover how nature works, we'll be able to harness it and make it better for us. But we have to first uncover how it works, and that's the basic science that people sometimes get a little bit impatient with. And I think we drive some of that impatience by using university press to get our stories out there. Oh, I made this discovery, and it's going to lead to this. Mostly that's BS. I made the discovery, and that's what Michigan State exists for, is to make discoveries. We're an institution. We're a leading research institution. We want those discoveries to go and help people and change lives, for sure. But just the knowledge itself changes lives, and that's really important. So that's a key element that I try to get out whenever I talk to the public, that the basic we I can tell you about really important things that we do today that we take for granted and maybe even therapeutically, but I can also and I can point to several of those that started as very occult and cryptic observations that somebody made. This, hey, this is kind of neat. And then they got really interested in understanding why that happened the way it did, and ultimately it led to some discoveries. But the original science was done just because somebody was curious about how something works.
For more, please visit empower.msu.edu. I'm Russ White for MSU Today, WKAR.
I'm Scott Westerman from the Michigan State University Alumni Association, with another observation from the Spartan Life. One of the regrets I have about the intensity of my great gig at MSU is that I don't have nearly the time I would like to spend with people who want to talk with me about career advice in person. I always start by guiding them to our superb MSUAA Alumni Career Services team. Our approach is a lot different than the resume polishers many of us may have experienced in the past. It's all about figuring out what you love and building a personal toolbox to help you get paid for doing it. On the occasions where it's impossible for me to sync up my schedule for a one-on-one, I share the high points in an email. And here they are.
Number one, discover your passion. Life is always much more fun if you're doing something you love. Number two, pick your company carefully. Too many people jump into cultures that are totally out of sync with who they are. To paraphrase Jim Collins in Good to Great, first where, then what? What are your top five favorite companies? Why? How could you add value there? Number three, draw a map. Stephen Covey says, begin with the end in mind. Where do you want to be 10 years from now? The more detailed a picture you can paint of your current ultimate objective, the easier it will be to design a roadmap to get you there. To follow up on picking your company carefully, which organizations might have your dream job? Where are the entry points for your dream career? What are the steps others have taken to get where you want to go? Assess your assets is number four. Once you know what makes you happy, it's a lot easier to aim toward that end. How have you prepared for that life? Are there any additional skills you need? How will you create and promote your personal brand? Number five, build a productive network. Connect with people who are already where you want to be. LinkedIn's power isn't in the quantity of people in your network. It's the quality. One of the best things about LinkedIn's search functionality is how you can parse your network for the companies and job types you're interested in, and then seek Spartans who already work in these places. These are the connections that will be the most important to you. Read Keith Ferrazzi's Never Eat Alone. It's not only the best networking book on the market, it's the best relationship book out there. Number six, add value before you are hired. Too many people ask me to help them find a job. In fact, we hire solutions and ideas, not people. If you have identified a company where you want to work, study it thoroughly. What are their strengths and weaknesses? Who are their competitors? What is their biggest current challenge? Think of ways you can help them overcome their problems and grow more successful. Imagine that you are a consultant and have been hired to help them grow the business. What would you recommend? How would you implement your idea? What would it cost? What resources would it require? If you've done this exercise, your career conversations will be much more fruitful. This is being proactive, and it pays off. And what if the job you want doesn't exist yet? A growing percentage of our graduates are working in positions that weren't around 5 years ago. Some even discovered that their research reveals an opportunity to create their own gig. Don't be afraid to create yours. Be professionally persistent. You will likely get rejected a number of times before someone realizes your value. That's okay. Keep in touch with the people you meet who work where you want to work. Share helpful links and productive ideas with them from time to time. Don't swamp them with email, but share ideas of real value when you find them. If you have been able to learn about their interests outside of work, seek ways to help them improve the quality of their lives. We tend to be attracted to people who genuinely care about us as individuals. We are repelled by pests. Keep the faith. This is the most important thing. If you maintain a focus on your objective, listen and act on the feedback you receive, build a productive network, and find ways to add value, you will inevitably get the job you seek. Never lose your capacity for hope. So ponder these points. You'll be able to ask the "Can you help me?" question much more effectively. When you get that face-to-face with an advisor or mentor, the conversation will be much more productive. And in the end, you'll discover that the question isn't, can you help me? It's, how can I help you?
I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Learn more about Spartans Helping Spartans at alumni.msu.edu.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear the show again, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.